low would be the low Q and the wide bandwidth. So that's where it keeps on giving most of us hams a major headache when it comes to Qs.
I think there are a couple aspects of this particular antenna design. And when I say design, it was very formulaic, the way he mentioned how it should have been built. And that's another issue here. Anyway, there's different parts of this design which are working against each other. There are high Q and low Q parts of the antenna, right? So if you're working with a particular wavelength and you're adding loading coils, it really confused me the way the antenna was designed. And that's what it was. It came down to a formula, right? If someone says this is the formula, and then you say, okay, I wound it on this coil, why didn't they tell me to wind it on the other coil? Well, that's the formula they came up with, that's what worked for them, and that's what they say should be done. Well, that's just their formula, and if we're engineers, we follow a formula and it works. If we're scientists, we try different things and see what works.
I guess so. I mean, you know, I once did an article about the different mindsets of a technician versus an engineer versus a scientist. And the principle of the article was basically we should try to merge all three of those personalities into one to kind of optimize what we do. I think it's reasonable to follow the rules the first time, and if it works and it doesn't work, then expand upon it rather than try something different than the article and then not quite know where you're going to go the next time. But, yeah, I mean, that's just been my experience with this hobby.
Excellent approach, and all the more reason why you should be leaving the TechNet ACTPL.
Thank you very much, Jim. I do appreciate it. I mean, that's how I kind of learned programming as well. There were open source programs available, and I took a look at them, and I tweaked them, and then I threw big parts of them out and substituted other parts. Eventually, it didn't look anything like the original, and I learned a great deal about programs, as opposed to kind of, you know, it's sort of the same thing, unfortunately, with DMR Code Plus. Most people will borrow someone else's code bug and eventually tweak it and make it their own. Some people just open up a blank code plug and start from scratch, but, you know, I don't know if that's a good idea for a newbie. You know, once you've played around with someone else's code plug, then yeah, sure. But it's always good to have a reference source, so you know where you're going in another direction. Yeah.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Good evening, Roy and the group. I have nothing to add on the antenna design. I'm quite crude at that, but I wanted to point out one possible thing that could be explained by the contact bridge related. If I understand that it was a 40-meter contact to Connecticut from Long Island to New York City area. Well within Nivis range, most likely, and it's possible that he was using a low-mounted dipole in Connecticut and bouncing off the island very easily getting to Rich. But Rich was shooting right over his head on the way back. So I think he has to experiment a little bit more to fill out this story a bit. But just a thought, as far as designing the antennas, I'm listening. I'm all ears. Over to Roy.
Okay, very good. That might be what's going on. As much as I appreciate the general concept of antenna reciprocity, and Dick may rest in peace, he's mentioned it very often, there's a lot of little loopholes for antenna reciprocity. Mike mentioned, there are some cases where things work better in one direction because their polarization angles tend to rotate in the other direction they don't, and height and lobe location, and of course power output change the reciprocity. So reciprocity is one of those squishy ideas that in principle is very nice, but in practice you have to allow for a lot of loopholes in nature to get around the reciprocity. So that's just my 2 cents on antenna reciprocity.
To sum it up, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut as much of the transmission line, cut as much off as I can, and I'm going to run a counterpoise from the shield of the coax going into the 49-1 and see what kind of difference that makes. Just to sum it up, back to you, Roy. Thanks.
Okay, I wish you luck, Rich, as always. John, you wanted to say something?
But yeah, just worried about reciprocity. I think reciprocity only holds for the antenna itself, being good for receiving as well as transmitting. The ionosphere propagation, that could be anything. That could be completely non-reciprocal. So as far as propagation, concerned, but the reciprocity is really, I mean, just for the antenna itself.
So we're still going about that antenna, huh?
Yeah, we're still going on that antenna. We'll be done with it soon, though. I just wanted to point out, well, it's very difficult to kind of divorce purely antenna characteristics from your antenna system, and including your transmitter. So, although, yeah, I agree with you, I don't know if you recall, we had a person who wanted to know if an antenna has a portion that receives and another portion of the antenna that transmits, and that's certainly the case where reciprocity kind of explains that it's all the same thing in both directions. But again, when people say reciprocity, they tend to expand the general comment to functional antennas as opposed to purely the antenna portion of the system. But I agree with you. It's a lot stricter if you just have the antenna alone. But it's very difficult to put that in an idea and have people understand, because they think their whole radio system with their antenna is their antenna.
Y'all ever figure out the winder situation with the antenna? I lost y'all for a little bit. My radio cut out.
Yes, Mike was able to spreadsheet the number of turns. They approximate the number of turns that Rich W2BZ did for his antenna. That was followed by the discussion of a proper counterpoise. Even theoretically, the benefit of a purely half-wave NFET is that it should not need a counterpoise, because it should operate as if it was a center-fed half-wave, where you just put the feed line at the far end, which should keep it passing sort of balance, but only increasing impedance to 2 or 3,000 ohms, and then correct it with a 49-1. But in the real world, you still need some degree of a counterpoise for any unbalanced antenna, and this acts as an unbalanced antenna, especially as soon as it gets off of the half-wave resonance.
Awesome.
D-E-C-A-L-D?
Yes.
This is Ivan, and while we're still on the subject of antennas, I'm a newly licensed ham, just got my test recently. And George, I believe the call sign is CBQFY2, suggested to me to take advantage of the opening 10 meter band that I still have privileges on. I live on the border of Regal Park and Forest Hills in an apartment complex, surrounded by other apartment complexes. And my question is, what would be the best shape form? I don't know what first anybody needs to learn. Best antenna, considering my aforementioned position. I live on the 6th floor of an apartment building, which is nice and advantage, but preferably indoor. Thank you.
Well, I'd recommend seeing if any of your neighbors have any, first of all. Maybe they have antennas in their apartments. Nope.
Well, that would be rather a fortuitous thing. I agree entirely, as I often do with George. Ten meters is jumping right now. I do a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 o'clock. I get the third Sunday off, so I had this week off, but it was very lively. There were a lot of people making contact. You talk to people easily in the Midwest. You can talk to people, we've spoken to people who are in England, and all over the United States, and occasionally Canada. So 10 meters is jumping, and it will probably get better over the next few years. The big question is what to use. Usually, an outdoor antenna is much better than an indoor antenna. Also, it has to do with the type of architecture, the way that the building was put together. If you have plasterboards, modern-day plasterboards, it's not too bad. My house was built in the 50s, so it's chicken wire and plaster, and so it's effectively a Faraday cage. So it's very difficult to get any signal outside of my house. So for my case, it was always outdoors. But you know, even if you can't get it outdoors, you might be able to put something either through the window or right next to the window, because that'll absorb less RF. But there's a whole bunch of different antennas that are designed. You know, there's compromises, all of them. Let me stop for a second. Okay, I mean, there's a lot of compromises. We mentioned earlier magnetic loops. They have to be retuned regularly if you change frequencies, but otherwise they're very small and compact, and can be very useful. Other people will get a, MSJ has a loaded coil whip that you can put on the windowsill, and you can adjust the tapping of an inductance coil to somewhat tune the antenna. And then you might benefit from having an antenna sooner available as well. There's a whole bunch of different compromise antennas, but they're very compromised. You know, a ham, basically quarter wave loaded foil type of design that you can put up and do. Of course, if anyone else has any bright ideas, please feel free for this new amateur radio operator here.
I have a question. What kind of radios y'all got, and does it affect on the radios? Because I have a Motorola ATX 8000. How does it affect having that type of radio versus a small, like, Bauerfang radio?
It's a little off topic. If you want, you can wait till we finish with this guy, and then you can ask that question. How's that? Anyway, anyone out there want to kind of share ideas, or if you were stuck in a, well, if you lived in a 6-floor apartment house and you were interested in 10 meters, so what kind of antenna would you set up for yourself? Yes, Fred.
Yeah, I was 10 meters halfway on. 10 meters is, what, like 12 or 13 feet. So you might actually be able to see a resonance antenna. Somebody correct me, I didn't do the calculation on halfway, but it may well be feasible in some apartment situations to do either a resonance halfway for a dipole in the window, or MFED might be easier, an MFED along the ceiling or something like that. I haven't, there's a caveat, so I haven't tried it, but given how short a 10-meter antenna could be, I think something like that might work. But in my experience, you're always better off with a resonance antenna. Lose too much with some compromised antennas. Go ahead.
I agree 100% agree with what Frank just said. W-A-2-C-D-L.
Yes, Andy. I just want to mention that at 10 meters, so a half wave is 5 meters, at approximately 15 feet. So I guess theoretically, if you really were stuck and you had to do it inside, if you have a length of wall that's 15 feet wide, you could staple the wire up to the wall and don't operate something from it, distance from it, something like that. But yes, Andy.
Yeah, that's probably your best bet. Who is that station? Do you have a call? I don't think he's licensed and shouldn't be on.
Okay, I agree with you, Andy. I think I talked to him earlier and I told him that. What can I tell you? It's been a little weird and a little hectic today.
Yeah, I just won't acknowledge someone unless they have a call. Basically, it is, my calculation is just information's sake. There's 3.28 feet per meter. 3.28 feet per meter. So multiply that by 10, that's 32.8 feet. And half of that is about, what's half of 32? 9... roughly 8 feet is a quarter wave, because 8 times 4 is 32. So you can look at it, you can get an average that way just by saying that. As long as you know there's 3.28 feet per meter, then you can just figure it out. So around an 8-foot whip is what we used on the car, and that's about a quarter wave on 10 meters. And, of course, 16 feet is a half wave, so on. Back to you, Roy.
I'm sorry, guys. I'm just new to the whole radio amateur channel thing. I didn't mean to get you guys all fired up. I'm just going to leave now, okay? I'm sorry about all that.
If you don't have a license to operate, you should not be on, just for the intonation sake.
What exactly is the penalty for not having the license? I do plan on having my license sometime very shortly from now.
No, please leave the airwaves. You can listen, but don't train.
The boys are fired up, huh?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of different ways that you can communicate. You can send me email. I gave you my email address. There's the chat room. You just type in chat.ac2gs.com. You can write anything you want. I'm looking at it all the time. There are other ways to communicate on the technical net that are legal. So I would suggest that you look into those ways. So consider getting yourself a license. It's not that difficult these days.
Okay,
and your first name is Ivan?
Correct.
Affirmative. Okay, very good. So, people have mentioned whips. People have mentioned half waves stapled to the wall. I mentioned magnetic loop. I mentioned the FGA adjustable loop. The best approach, obviously, would be if you had some kind of arrangement for your landlord that you could put up a relatively simple vertical. I myself have a stereo. 2016 is a 5/8 wave vertical. It's a very compact, simple, it doesn't look scary at all. I have it on my roof, maybe about 9 feet of elevation above my and it gives me a great antenna, but I could understand, you know, some people just can't piss off their landlord into letting them put up a roof antenna. So, I mean, these are other options. If someone else has any ideas, please feel free, especially if you have a license, to share them.
The LP is expired, Les.
ALP is an expired license, you say? Kilo Echo Alpha Lima Papa. Got my license, I believe, in November.
November,
and I still have 10 years to go.
Okay, Roger, you caught the station too. Apologies. Station is just on the truck.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have an expired KE2 because they just started to give the KE2s about 6 months ago, by the way.
Sounds like somebody's lying.
Anyway, does anyone want to offer any constructive information, like what kind of 10-meter antenna they would put up if they were living on the sixth floor of an apartment complex?
Yes,
Mike. I know I was going to go about a couple minutes ago, but y'all never answered my question about the APX 8000 Motorola Yellow Edition.
I don't know if this gentleman is legal or not, but if I may offer a solution that I did when I was stationed down at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. One, I used the MFJ apartment antenna, which worked very nicely. Except it did have some common mode, but you know, so the radio bit a little bit. The other solution that I used was a remote tuner, and I actually energized my apartment building's gutter system, which worked reasonably well.
Okay, that's interesting. Rich W2BZ tried that for with his rain gutters. I don't know if Ivan has access to rain gutters. You know, if you have access to your rain gutters, it's not that big a difference, but for some he might be in a situation where he doesn't want to demonstrate that he has any antennas at all, and he wants to do a rather stealth approach. Who knows what the landlord is expecting. But, yeah, I mentioned the MFJ. It's not the most efficient antenna in the world, but if you kind of suck, it certainly is better, in my opinion, on the windowsill than, say, an indoor antenna, depending upon the type of insulation and shielding that's going on in the walls in your apartment house. You know, you don't know until you try it out, I guess. But, yeah, there are a couple of compromises. You're not going to get as far out as people who just put it on their roof. You're going to be blocked by one side of the building. But, you know, there are options out there. And, you know, we all started with not terribly good options and compromises. As time went on, we figured either cleverer ways of getting around it or we moved.
And last comment, oh, let me let it be. And the other solution, which I highly recommend, is getting the book from the ARRL with antennas for small spaces. I found that highly useful. It laid out many, many ideas. And, well, it's always magnetic. But, yeah, the ARRL book, antennas for small spaces.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. Jeff, you want to say?
Absolutely. A lot of great, great information here tonight. My opinion was a screwdriver antenna. You can sit it anywhere, and I put it on the back of my Jeep in the middle of Connecticut and hit Germany with 50 watts.
Okay, those are great antennas, especially for mobile. What they effectively are variable inductor short width. So they're like having an adjustable ham stick. They use basically the same type of motor mechanism as the screwdriver in order to order to adjust the tapping area of the loading coil of the whip. You could do it that way. It's a little bit more expensive than, say, the MSJ, which has a manual version of that. It basically has a whip, and it has a loading coil at the base, and then it has a little attachment where you short out portions of the loading coil, and you make the adjustments manually as opposed to the screwdriver motor adjusting it for you. So probably costs a little bit less than the average screwdriver. A screwdriver antennas are great designs, especially for mobile purposes. I think they're probably one of the better designs out there. Still, it's a compromise, unfortunately. It does limit efficiencies and increases the view, it decreases bandwidth, and all kinds of fun stuff like that. But yeah, that's a good idea as well.
AETALT, thank you very much for all your suggestions. And I think go ahead and check the
And please, if you have any questions or problems or just want to hang out, we're here every Sunday night starting at 8 o'clock p.m.
Appreciate that.
Okay, our second person who checked in tonight, call sign ends in KPQ, I believe. Are you still with us? Yes, Frank.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on the one-way skip issue. Rather move on to something else.
Sure, Frank. You know, we can do that.
And I think it's entirely possible there are multiple explanations. First of all, I do agree with the idea that most of the time, not all of the time, but the majority of the time, my experience has been that you can get more or less reciprocal reports if your antenna is working properly. And I agree, you're not going to get those results all of the time because of what appears to be one-way skip. Another explanation I've heard, which is the experiment you'll find is very plausible, is different noise levels at different ends of the circuit. For example, on 40 meters, I found for years using the ground mounted vertical that after sunset, about sunset and after sunset, some DXers call it gray line, I could work amazing DX with the ground mounted vertical. Before sunset, hardly any one overseas person. And when I asked Dick about it on TechNet years ago, his explanation was what he called shower effect. That is, and I tried it. If I'm standing in the shower, very noisy with a lot of noise, and my wife is talking to me from the outside, she couldn't hear me talking to her, but I have a great deal of difficulty hearing her talking to me because of the difference in noise level. And I think on some bands like 40, 80, 160,
mobile could really be a computer system.
And you may have a much higher noise level at night, let's say, on 40 and 80 meters. So in Europe, even though they'll sound quiet when it's still daylight here, they can't necessarily hear you because their noise level at night in Europe is quite high. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, that sounds like a good reason. The problem I have is that you could probably test that theory if you have a legitimate edge meter that's well calibrated, because the signal itself is going to be at the same number of microwatts. So if you have a well calibrated edge meter, you know the noise. The concept is makes sense to me that if your noise floor is, which is a local phenomena, is higher than the signal strength, then you're not going to hear the other person. It would be interesting to figure out how you could. The trouble is, if that's the case, then you can't hear the signal. You have no way of telling what the signal strength was. But that would kind of mean that you could probably suss out with the internet what the baseline noise level strength is, and be able to kind of attempt to somewhat prove that idea, where you're not hearing them, and they're hearing you, and they tell you that you have a calibrated S2, and your noise floor is S3, or something like that.
Three SDRs online are, but with modern online SDR technology, can probably set up a really good experiment and also experiment with multiple antennas and polarizations to see how that theory plays out on HF. I know in the commercial world, amateurs don't use it too much, but in the commercial world, it's something called diversity of reception. We have antennas receive on several antennas in different locations to combat fading. So I know that's the way it's dealt with in the commercial world. Go ahead.
Okay. That's the kind of the beauty of a lot of software-defined radios. You know, my Flex actually gives you a pretty accurate assessment of the signal strength. You can get it in S units. You can get it in W100 that I'm using right now to do this. Has a terrible S meter. The S meter is wired in with the automatic gain circuit. And so if you change the ATC, it'll give you a different reading for your S meter reception. So it's useless. But with software-defined radios, it's theoretically possible to do that. It's sort of a shame I can't kind of arrange for a bunch of people to kind of do that. You know, the only problem is you're only going to have a one-way conversation. Or see if it's a legitimate explanation for the reason why it works that way.
Lots of amazing experiments have been set up using some of the online receivers that are out there that you can use for free. And that allows for multiple users. Probably some very interesting stuff you can do to test out some of these theories that there was just no practical way to do years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a shame that, you know, we think of these interesting things, but we don't have the time to actually sit down and organize it, because organizing it is probably takes more effort than just thinking them up. But, you know, I've kind of thought about the concept of antenna reciprocity for many years. It was one of the things that Dick used to love to talk about. You know, as John mentioned, it's more of an inherent, solely antenna-oriented concept that unfortunately people have extended and expanded to the entire stack. The so-called antenna system, you know, sometimes we think of the antenna system as the antenna tuner, the transmission line, and the antenna. Sometimes we think of it as the entire stack. So, someone who's good at organization or such, they should sit down and try that out. It might even generate a good QST article.
Well, even if you do a really serious old experiment, even a good hand-side paper, the whole group of people who, there's a whole community called hand-scientists, people who help out the PhD physicists with all these experiments.
There's a lot of junior scientists out there and legitimate scientists who have careers in different fields who sometimes they apply all that training and rigor to this subject. I think of Joe Taylor, who's a Nobel Prize winner, and he took his spare time out to help engineer a whole class of computer algorithm signals that are being used in moon bounce and generating a lot of wallpaper for virtual everything stations that FT8 has been. So, if you're out there listening to us, if you have some free time, organize something like that. Write an article and come over and talk about it here.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I did manage to do a DSCC on FT8 using a remote station for just a few minutes a day. I'm curious, how easy is it to do DSCC on FT8? And was in fact pretty easy.
Well, yeah, it's a lot easier now than it ever was. Every so often when I have absolutely nothing better to do, I'll listen in and see the activity of FT8. And FT8 kind of jumped in popularity almost as soon as Joe Taylor released it. And I haven't seen it ever since. It's active on all the bands now that 10-meter propagation is much better than it has been in the past. It's lively on 10 meters, along with certainly 20 and 40. And of course, there's guys out there, old time guys, who said that's not fair. You're cheating. You're using the computer. It's not really amateur radio. You're not using your ears. You're using your computer. There's a small part of me that says, it's kind of like I mentioned this before. Any sport that you can drink beer while you're doing the sport is not a sport. So, I don't know. There was at least one person who hang out in the chat room tried FT8, and he was able to accomplish a great deal in FT8 as he was hanging out in the chat room. I think he felt that it wasn't terribly rewarding because of that. I think some people actually want a challenge. You can set up, there are automated systems, there are robot FT8 programs. You just kind of hit a button and it sort of
does it all for you. You know, it's an interesting concept. When does it cease to be a personal action and just an automated process that you turn the on button with?
Yeah, well, I think there was a kerfuffle maybe a year or two ago about an IOTA, Islands on the Air activation in the Pacific. I think it was one of the islands in Fiji that ran a half dozen automated stations on all bands at the same time. And the IOTA program in Britain ruled that they weren't going to count it because the station was automated and nobody was actually operating. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's the ongoing problem. Technology is increasingly able to take us out of the equation. I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the net that I'm playing around with the infamous ChatGPT. It's a chatbot, artificial intelligence. Apparently, students are using it to generate papers. People are using it to generate stories, articles. It does a very good job. If you just type into it, you know, a question, even a technical question, it does a halfway decent job of textually describing it reasonably well. There's no illustration because it's all text-based. But the future is we're all going to be replaced. You know, maybe someday instead of me sitting here, you'll just have a voice synthesizer plugged into a chat GPT clone or a future generation of chat GPT clone.
Yeah, when I get around to it, and I've heard you speak, ChatGPT right now, because it's been so well publicized, they, you know, it crashed or something. But anyway, when I can, just for the fun of it, I'm just going to generate articles for my blog. Interesting. But I think FDA has some value. You learn a lot about propagation and see when the band is really open when you think it's dead. I think it was sometime last summer, I put FDA on 12 meters late at night when the band should be dead, and my scene immediately filled almost completely with Chinese patients, mainland China. I didn't work any of them, but I was just amazed to see a screen completely filled with Chinese patients when there was nothing else showing up on the scope. Go ahead.
Well, I haven't had this experience with the lower HF band, but 10 meters seems to not be at all unusual for these shortcut ducts to just kind of appear in the F1, F2 ionosphere. It just kind of connects Brooklyn with odd places. I mentioned a few weeks ago that I spoke out of five contacts, four of the contacts I made one after the other was with people from Lincoln, Nebraska. And it wasn't that Lincoln, Nebraska was having some kind of a contest or that they all knew each other and contacted each other to contact me. It was just kind of random. So it just like this duct opens up that connected Brooklyn with Lincoln, Nebraska, of all places. I haven't heard too many stories about that on the lower frequency band, so I don't know if that's quite the same thing there, but I have noticed it in 10 meters.
I think 10 and 6 meters are noticed for that. You see some things like that at gray line on other bands. I remember years ago, 7 o'clock possibly be seen. I think it was on a fall evening. I was convinced it was a swim, a pilot. Yet, I got the QSL call. You know, on the lower frequency, just around sunset and sunrise, it's a really astonishing propagation happening. It only lasts for a couple of minutes and it's gone. Go ahead.
Yeah, and a lot of times these apparent propagations defy any kind of decent explanation. You know, there are times that 10 meters should be dead as the proverbial doornail, and in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden it opens up and you hear a bunch of things. So, you know, you don't question good luck. You just kind of jump in on it, and if you... If it ceases, which it usually unfortunately does, then that's, you enjoy it, you know, as long as the ride is going. There's some things that we can explain. There are some things that we can give a good guesstimate. And there are some things that just randomly happen in the universe. So we haven't quite figured those ones out. But, you know, it all comes together as an exciting hobby. If amateur radio was as consistent as commercial communication, cell phones, and other such, there'd be less of us in the hobby. I think the unpredictability and the somewhat randomness, chance of it all, draws a lot of people to this hobby. So that's a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the fun parts about that. And yeah, I know there are some attempts being made to use using Whisper to document that phenomena. You know, those short openings at night on 10 meters, 60 meters, I think that you wouldn't expect. And I think a lot of guys are doing Whisper plots to try to figure out what's going on with that. Anyway, that's the thing to do here, so I'm going to get out of here. And I'll be back a little later for the space section. WB2BS, so let's indulge in the Roy.
Okay, very good, Frank. Anytime. WB2BS with the Weimar Technical Net. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock until about 11. I'll try and see if James is still out there. I kind of, you know, he checked in number two, and maybe we took a little too long getting to him. So if you're out there, I think it's James, KP2KPQ. If you have a question still, if you're out there, please respond. Okay, I guess we took too long to get to this question. Anyway, once again, it's ACCGS. My name is Roy. Again, this is the Weimar Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topic for discussion, feel free. Hit that push the talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Yes, Leslie.
Do you know how AC routing machine works?
Could you say it again? I sounded like you said AC wording.
The arc welding, AC arc welding. Interesting.
Oh, arc welding. Well, I've never done arc welding. My understanding is that a high voltage potential is brought to bear in a short gap, and that generates a very, very hot point source so that metals are melted and welding takes place.
Hey, Katie, 2MZ. Yeah, I've done a lot of arc welding in my day. It's actually low voltage, about 30 to 450 volts. DC.
AC. There seems to be a disagreement of whether it's AC or DC.
It can be both. It can be both. Modern welding arc is DC. AC is old school. Not a splatter. with AC.
Okay, so I have a positive. You have a transformer, and nothing works by the transformer, and you want to have a regulated current of the welding. How do you do that?
Wesley, very simple. You go to Harbor Freight, you buy yourself a $179 welder. It'll work fine. I've been using it for years. So complicated. Harbor Freight makes a great welder. It's a MIG welder type of range. It works great. Real cheap. So complicated.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. That was absolutely amazing answer. Dr. Roy, what is it? Dr. Roy, how do you think you could regulate the current of the world? Back to you.
Having never owned one, I don't know how specifically you want to explain it to us. By the way, for people listening out there, MIG, I believe, means a metal inert gas. Isn't that what a MIG welder stands for, MIG?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Use an inert gas, so when you've got your arc, the metal doesn't oxidize. You can also use a flux core, which works the same way. Like I said, guys, I've been welding for years, and they're really relatively cheap. Unless, of course, you're a professional and you're welding something like a pipeline, well, then it's a different story. But if you want to weld, go to Harbor Freight, buy yourself a flex core. It's about $179. They're on sale over the weekend, and you'll never go wrong. And yes, they do regulate the current by just adjusting the knob. It's already done. Why reinvent the wheel?
So, I was interested to if anybody could explain how the current regulation could be done in the simple AC transformer used for arc welding.
Well, you know, very rare these days. All that is the big old rheostat. Wesley, again, I've been welding for years. The technology you're quoting is about 50 years old. DC's the way to go. Trust me on that one, buddy. You don't want to use an AC welder. I used it in high school, and it made a mess.
Daniel Bond, Rack Welder, K2GJE. He's talking about stick welding, over.
Yeah, same thing. Stick welding, you also use DC. It's preferable. Again, I've been welding for years, guys. Wesley, why do you care? Go out and buy yourself a welder if you want to go weld. Trust me on that one. KD2AMZ clear.
I'll see you, yes. I'm interested if anybody could explain how the current could be regulated in the transformer, the AC transformer, no DC yet, and that is used for welding. So let's say you don't have a Harbor Freight yet, because you've been thrown somewhere in Siberia, and you have, let's say, a transformer from a microwave, so you're removing one of the winding, you're leaving the primary winding, you take the thick cable, and then you have a welder, right?
They got him in Siberia, too, and what the hell would you do in Siberia now anyways? Wesley, just go buy one. Oh, by the way, it's regulated by a Variac.
No, it is not, because the Variac is lowering the current. I said you have a transformer. And in that transformer, that is the technology that is actually 80 years old. And they've been doing all the time. They were able to regulate the current. So what actually they were doing with the transformer, Dr. Roy?
Well, I decided to experiment, and I asked ChatGPT what his opinion of this answer is. and he's still writing. I'll read it to you. Just for the sake of hearing from an artificial intelligence. One second, let me drop this back. I don't think anyone's going to be happy with this one. It says, in an AC welder, the current is regulated by a control panel or interface that allows the user to adjust the amount of current flowing through the welding circuit. This is typically done by adjusting the output voltage of the welding power source, which in turn affects the amount of current flowing through the electrode and the workplace, the workpiece. Some AC welders also use the secondary controls, such as a foot pedal, to adjust the current while the welder is in use. This allows the welders to make precise adjustments to the current as needed during the welding process. So it's prescriptive, but not really explanatory.
Hey, like I said, guys, it's called a VARIAC, a variable coil transformer. Old technology going back to 100 years.
Well, actually, VARIAC is not being used in welding. At least not widely, at least I didn't meet that. What they do is actually, if you have a DE shape of the core, metal core, and then you have another E shape of metal core, and you put them together, then you have two spaces for the coil. So you're winding one coil next to the other instead of one coil on the top of the other. And then, if you are able to pull that leg that is in the middle of the E, letter E, out and in, that's how you regulate the magnetic flux that is flowing in the core. And that's how you regulate the current. But also, there is another one. You have a choke. You could have actually choke that is connected between one of the electrodes and one of the secondary windings. And this choke could have a removable metal core. So you're regulating the induction of the Q, I'm sorry. You're regulating the Q of this coil, and that's how you regulate the current. The third way of doing it is, that was done since 1900. There were actually moving coil that was very heavy, 600 pounds, 700 pounds, a transformer core, and you had a secondary coil, a primary coil moved, physically moved up and down. So it was a space between the primary and the secondary. But also, when you had the one of the coil, that coil moved along with part of the metal core, which was the, like you have the E shape, the middle of it, so it created a gap. Similarly to that, the CRT and TVs, they were using a flyback transformer having a little gap on it. Back to you, Dr. Ross.
Okay, that's interesting. Yes, I've never really owned a welding machine, and Mike indicates that AC welding is kind of an old tech type of thing, and now DC is the thing, so probably not going to be getting into either side of welding in the near future.
That's Swat.
Gene, if you're in Siberia, I'll tell you how.
Yeah, definitely somebody with better English could actually explain how the process is being done better. Interesting. The space report professionally trying to say something.
I keep doubling. Do I have it, Lawrence?
Yes, Paul, you have it now.
Yeah, the old welders that we have, probably in the early 70s, we had, it looked like a torpedo. You wheel them into the building, very heavy. And what it was an AC motor. And that AC motor would just spin up another, would actually spin up a generator. And you would take that, and then that would they would set that for DC, like we say in a variac. You could set it at, you know, 90 amps, 80 amps, 70 amps, or, you know, or higher if you wanted. And then, you know, that was the system. And of course, nowadays, you know, I got my own little welder too. You know, a nice little Lincoln portable thing. You know, with an inverter and everything. Things really change, you know. Yeah, it's a big difference. You know, you gotta go back to the old days with these old big heavy Lincoln welders. You don't have to do that. Back to you, right?
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, once again, modern times, modern